Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we do what we do and believe what we believe? Being most familiar with the activity of our conscious minds, it's easy to overlook the powerful influence that lies beneath the surface, the drives and cravings of hormones, the desires fed by raw emotion, and the value of our tendency to make snap judgments about whether or not to trust other people. The power of all that under-recognized influence fascinates New York Times columnist and NewsHour commentator David Brooks. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement, and in it he explores what makes us the people we are through the lens of science and the stories of a fictional couple, Harold and Erica, whom he follows from before birth through the last days of their lives. David, welcome to Think.
Hey, great to be with you.
So we all like to think we know what we're doing. Are we just deluding ourselves?
Mostly. So we sort of know what we're doing, but there are all sorts of things happening below the level of our awareness that we're only vaguely aware of. So just some silly things. For example, when you go out to eat, if you go out alone, you'll eat a certain amount. If you go out with one other person, you'll eat on average 35% more. And if you go out with three or more other people, you'll eat on average 70 or 80% more. And you're not really aware of that, but those are things that are happening. When you get married, we tend to marry people with similar nose widths to our own, similar eye widths apart. We marry people whose immune systems are complementary to our own, which we measure through smell and by tasting each other's saliva. And so there are all these other influences going on in our lives that are just the tip of the iceberg. And the important thing, or actually they are the iceberg, our consciousness is the tip of the iceberg. And the important thing is that most of the stuff that's going on down there is not stupid. It's not dumb emotion. It's there for a reason. But it's just a whole different layer of awareness that helps us, shapes who we are and what we do.
Before we get further into this, David, we should probably talk about the term unconscious as you use it here, because inevitably we hear from people who insist that unconscious only refers to the state we're in when we're asleep or knocked out.
Right. That's a good point. So one way to think about this is that the human mind can take in about 12 million pieces of information, of which it can be conscious of about 40. That's more metaphorical, but that gives you the rough proportion. So we're thinking about a few things with a shot, like a spotlight, but a lot of what we do every day, we're not even thinking about. Most of us are not really aware of what our bodies are doing at any moment, but our different parts of our mind are thinking about that. Sometimes you'll be driving down the street and you'll be having a conversation or listening to the radio. You're not even aware of how you're driving or where you're going, but other parts of your mind are doing that. And most importantly, you're not really aware of a lot of the things that are going on in a relationship at any one time. The way you're mimicking each other's breathing patterns in conversation, the way you're responding to other people's emotional tones and signals. And even some of our most fundamental decisions are affected by things that we're not even aware of. So one of my favorite bits of research I stumbled across from a guy at the University of Buffalo found that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence become lawyers. That's why my own daughter is named President of the United States Brooks. But all that stuff is happening unconsciously while we're fully awake, but in parts of the mind that we're not aware of.
And there are actually huge advantages to the fact that we don't have to think about all of this.
Right. What our unconscious is, it's a different way of thinking about the world and trying to understand the world. So consciously, we have a certain system for understanding the world, and it tends to be logical and linear and linguistic. We can talk about it. But unconsciously, we have a bunch of different systems that help us perceive the world. My newspaper did a great story about some soldiers in Iraq, and they could look down the street in Baghdad, and they could tell whether there was an IED, a bomb, somewhere in the street. And when you ask them, well, how do you know? They would say, well, I really couldn't tell you, but I feel a coldness inside. And that's unconscious perception. And some people are really good at picking out the patterns in a complicated situation. Some people are really good at attuning to others and sort of understanding what they're thinking. Other people are less good at these things. But these processes can be very smart. So, for example, one of the tips I got from one researcher was that if you're having trouble making a decision, tell yourself you're going to flip a coin. But then don't go by the way the coin flips. Go by your emotional reaction to whether it comes up heads or tails. Are you happy or sad it came out the way it did? And that's your inner mind more or less telling you what it wanted all along.
So what you're describing there sounds like the times when our unconscious and our inner mind comes into conflict with what we think rationally should be the right thing to do.
Well, there are sometimes conflicts, but mostly they're the same. And this is one of the misperceptions we have, is that emotion is one thing and reason is something else, and the two are opposite. And that if we're being emotional, then we're not being rational. And if we're being rational, we're not being emotional. The research on this is very clear. That's not true. Emotion are not separate from reason. Emotion is the foundation from reason. Because what our emotions do is they tell us what we value. They look across the world and they react to, they admire something, they want something, they love something, they fear something, they detest something, they're disgusted by something. And so our emotions are really the foundation of our reason. And there's a scientist named Antonio Damasio at USC who studied people who've had lesions, strokes in parts of their brain, and they can't process emotion. And these people are not super smart, Mr. Spocks. They're super dumb because they can't value things. And if you can't value things, what you want, what you don't want, you can't make sophisticated decisions.
So I want to talk about how you structured the book, The Social Animal. You have these two characters, Harold and Erica, and you sort of follow them through their entire lives. An interesting choice you made was that at each stage in their lives, it's like 2010, 2011. You didn't have them born in 1930 and follow them. Can you talk about why you did it that way?
Right, because I created the characters because even though a lot of the research is conducted in labs, I wanted to show how it plays out in real life. Mm-hmm. I also thought it would just make it more fun because I could do some social commentary. And because the research shows that we're influenced by information on the conscious level, which is logical and argumentative, but also on the unconscious level, which prefers stories and narratives. So I wanted the book to engage people on all those different levels. And then I kept it in the current day, and I hope it's not too noticeable, mostly because I wanted to be able to describe how people are living now at each stage in life and how the research shows how we're living now. So, for example, one of the things I write about in the book, when they're in their 20s, we've had this change over the last 20 years in how we think about being 20 or 25 or 27. Up until about 20 years ago, most people by age 27 had achieved sort of the three foundations of adulthood. They'd been married, they'd had kids, they'd bought a house. But over the last 30 years, there's been sort of a change in behavior. So now the number of people in their 30s who have done that is much, much lower. People are more or less taking their 20s as a chance to sort of experiment. I call them the Odyssey years, where people are experimenting with different careers, different lifestyles, different places to live. Their parents are going quietly insane while they watch their kids do this during their 20s. But it's not a stupid thing to do. I think it's a good idea in a complicated economy to spend your time trying on different careers, different lifestyles, to see what fits you rather than being committed too early to something that's not quite right for you.
When you write about Harold, you write about some fascinating research about how babies are sort of biologically wired to make their parents, and particularly their mothers, care deeply about them. Can you talk a little bit about how that happens?
Yeah, babies come into the world wanting to invade mom's brain, more or less. And so one of the researchers, a guy named Alan Meltzoff at the University of Washington, leaned over a baby who was 43 minutes old and wagged his tongue at the baby, and she wagged her tongue back at 43 minutes. And she wasn't really aware of him or a face or anything else. She just knew that babies mimic what they see. And that's how they reenact in their own minds what's around them. That's how they download information. So babies are phenomenally good at reading faces. A baby can take a look at different monkey faces and tell the difference between one monkey and another. Adults, we've lost that ability because it's not as important to us. And so what babies do is they really invade mom's brain, and they use her brain as a way to download information to ours. And this is in some ways a loving process, in some ways a very violent and invasive process. So while a baby is awake, the average baby will ask for mom's attention every 20 seconds. The average mother loses 700 hours of sleep time that first year. Marital satisfaction plummets about 70%. And so this is a very invasive process. But the effect is that the mother and child or father and child really merge. And I remember having this phenomenon with my own kids when I would look at them, maybe they were a year old or so, and I would think, you know, I feel like I know this person as well as I've known any other person on earth, and yet we've never actually exchanged a word because the kids don't talk yet. And so it's kind of remarkable how much you can know someone, how much you can share before words come into the picture.
And it is this sort of two-way street, this relationship, so that when parents respond consistently and appropriately to whatever it is their kids need, those children form secure attachments, and those attachments last far beyond infancy or even childhood and well into adulthood.
Right. So by 18 months, say, 55% of American kids have what the researchers call secure attachments. That means they have a healthy two-way communication with mom or dad. And when they go out into the world, into school or into the neighborhoods, they'll know how to build relationships. And scientists can take a look at attachment patterns at 18 months old and predict with 77% accuracy who's going to graduate from high school. About 20% of the kids have what they call avoidant attachments, which is to say they've been sending out signals, but for whatever reason, nothing is coming back. And those kids do less well in life. They'll have many fewer friends even at age 70. Now, it should be pointed out that nothing that happens in the first 18 months of life locks you in. Different things that can happen that can compensate. You can discover great friends or a great mentor or a grandparent or a parent. But they open up pathways. And these early things that happen early in life are often very influential about what happens through life.
And then if those attachments are secure, and, you know, we don't want to take this too far, but parents can screw up along the way or yell at their kids occasionally, and it's not really going to damage the fundamental security that the children have.
Yeah, unless it's super traumatic. But, you know, one of the experiments they did is they gave kids shots in the course of their childhood. You know, they go to the doctor, get a shot for whatever. And kids with secure attachment patterns, they'll cry with the pain, but then they recover quickly. Kids with insecure attachment patterns, their cortisol level shoots up because they live in what they perceive as a much more stressful world. And when something happens that's bad, like getting a shot at the doctor's office, they become much more discombobulated at it because their sensors for stress are just set at a much more sensitive level. And so this is a way in which these models we have in our heads are pathways and ways we perceive the world. And as I said, you can take a kid from a very who's been traumatized in childhood, and by surrounding them with a healthy relationship later on, you can overcome these things. The brain is plastic and will adjust, but they are pathways that open up.
Can any of those pathways be repaired in a classroom setting? We have so many kids coming into schools that seem to be at a great disadvantage on a variety of levels.
Yeah, I think they can. In the book, I have one of my characters who comes from a home with a poverty-stricken home with mm-hmm. a mom who's a single mom who suffers from depression. And she more or less forces herself into a school called the Academy, which is modeled after KIPP academies. And they what they do at KIPP academies is they not only teach kids information, English, math, and stuff like that, but they give them ways of seeing the world. They teach them how to look at people in the eye when they're talking to them, how to nod in agreement, how to walk down the hallway. They're really focusing on the whole person, giving people an organized culture from which they can look at the world. And really raising their sights. So when you go to a KIPP school, the classroom may be named after the college the teacher went to get things kids thinking about college. Mm. Their graduation year will not be the year they're graduating from high school. It'll be the year 4 years hence when they're expected to graduate from college. Mm. And these are all subtle ways to expand their horizons and to give them an ordered framework from which to live their lives. And this can happen, by the way, in adulthood. It can happen in old age. One of the pieces of good news from this research is the brain is plastic throughout life. New neurons are being born, new connections are being made throughout life from birth to death, and we can always influence ourselves no matter how old and how established we are in our ways.
My guest this hour is David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times and commentator for PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David Brooks will be in town to address the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live Series in partnership with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth on Wednesday, March 30th. That's at 7:30 in the evening. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call us at 1-800-933-533. Or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Thank God, KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Brooks. He's a columnist for The New York Times and commentator for PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. You can find out more about David's upcoming appearance at the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live event by going to the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to go back for a minute to this character, Erica, who is the one who attended the Kip-like school. What I really like about her is that from the beginning, she has this extraordinary sort of drive to succeed and this motivation and this demand for what she knows she needs. What do we know about what separates someone like an Erica from someone else who's born in similarly difficult circumstances who can't quite pull it together in the same way?
Well, some people, temperament is real. We're born with certain temperaments, and we're not sentenced to our temperament, but it is real. And so, for example, there's a scientist who took a look at kids and measured how quickly they react to stress, how angry they got. He measured them when they're very young, and then through the course of their lives. And the kids who are very outgoing, it doesn't mean they'll stay on the extreme of outgoing all their lives, but they'll probably not swing all the way over to shyness. And so we stay within the lanes of our basic temperament. And some kids are enormously resilient. And for example, about a third of the kids who even suffer physical abuse as kids, they show no effects of it later on. And we don't really understand where that resilience comes from. The character Erica I have has tremendous drive. And I think that comes, and this is really meant to exemplify the research, it comes in many cases from a sense of the fragility of life between the age of 10 and 12. Hmm. One of the fascinating things that I came across was that an amazing number of people who've been great composers, great political leaders, great writers, they had a parent die or disappear between the ages of about 10 or 14. And that gave them a sense of the fragility of life and a tremendous desire to establish a security for themselves. And many people become hyper-ambitious, both in good ways like Lincoln or bad ways like Stalin. And so that sense of fragility is really his drive qualities. And what Erica needs, what many of us need, is to live within the context of an ordered existence. And she, her great insight is that as at one point in her life when her mom is depressed and has to be institutionalized, and Erica at even age 10 or 12 has to learn how to check her into the hospital, has to learn how to feed herself bologna from the local bodega, she has an intuitive awareness that often we're not strong enough to change our own minds, but we can choose the environment in which we will live, and that environment will change our life. And she more or less forces her way into a Kip Academy, which has this profound effect. And this is true for the rest of us. It's very hard to sit down and think, well, I will become a different sort of person. That's why New Year's resolutions generally fail. But we can say, I will join the Marine Corps, or I will go to this college, or I will join the priesthood. And when you throw yourself into a different environment, that environment will change you in ways you don't understand. And that's one of the ways we can really change our unconscious minds.
What influence does peer pressure have, both good and bad?
It has tremendous, tremendous influence. If you look at whether people are obese, whether they're lonely, whether they're happy, these things are all powerfully predicted by what our friends are doing. And one of the oddities of obesity research, for example, is that our friends have much greater influence on us than our spouses. And so when a group of friends gain some weight, then that weight gain will spread through the friendship network. Hmm. And pretty much everyone else, most people will gain weight along with that. And that's because we're not solitary individuals who think things through. That's part of who we are, but we're deeply interpenetrated people and there are loops going through our minds in ways that we're very vaguely aware of. And some of these have very good effects. So, for example, we tend to feel sympathy one for another. If you take a baby in a nursery and it hears another baby crying, that baby will cry in sympathy, but it won't cry at the recording of its own voice. It doesn't feel any sympathy for itself. Hmm. And so that's a good way we empathize with one another, and many people think that instinct is really the basis of morality. But in other ways, it's not so good. If you're in a peer group that is encouraging you to behave in self-destructive ways, then it's very, very hard to resist, even when you know it's wrong. And one of the things the Alcoholics Anonymous do, for example, is they surround you in a peer group encouraging you to behave in certain ways. And Alcoholics Anonymous stumbled upon the core finding, which a lot of the research confirms, which is don't sit there and make resolutions about how you're going to behave. Change your behavior, and then that behavioral change will rewire your mind. The AA slogan is fake it till you make it. And that's true. Change your behavior, then change your mind. Don't think you can change your mind and then change your behavior.
We have an email here from Mickey in Addison who writes, some of the most successful and accomplished people I know have no empathy and even have to learn to show emotion. On the other hand, too much empathy seems to make people dysfunctional. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there are some spheres where people without a great deal of empathy can, or at least without, let's put it this way, without a great deal of obvious social skill can do well. I think if you're in the high-tech industry and you spend your days in front of a computer screen, or you're a hedge fund guy who likes to look at the charts in front of a computer screen, then you can do well. An economist can sometimes do well, philosophers. But in most spheres, that's not true. I just saw research last week of Google, which is certainly a high-tech sphere, but they did a big survey with millions and millions of data points on which executives were doing well and what was important. And they came to the study thinking, well, technical expertise really is important at a place like Google. You got to be able to write software code. They found it was important, but it was the least important of the traits they measured. The most important trait was, can an executive sit down with an employee one-to-one, have a meeting, and really coach an employee through a problem? Can they emotionally relate? And that is by far the most important trait in most spheres. If you want to know who's going to succeed in life, go into a kindergarten classroom and ask a kid, who is friends with who in this classroom? Some kids are oblivious, but some kids are really aware of social networks. And those kids have a huge leg up. And I think the general research suggests that people with those traits, the ability to take turns while talking, the ability to learn from other people, the ability to relate to other people, those are the key traits.
And that's a set of traits that you gave to your character, Harold, who also in high school has this one teacher that he just really adores. And that turns out to be a big predictive factor of success as well.
Right, having that one teacher. And often it's not the actual subject matter that matters. It's the way of being. The teacher shows a way of being in the world, the way of being a learner or a scholar. And Harold is a popular high school athlete who gets by on charm, and he has great social skills. He can go to the different cliques in the cafeteria and sort of blend in with each clique as he enters their domain. But maybe he doesn't have as much depth as maybe he needs to. And this teacher, who's sort of emotionally very overwrought in some ways, but is a great teacher because she understands, she intuits what he needs, and she intuits what he longs for, and he longs for something deeper than himself. And she gives him a book on Greek history, which introduces him to some concepts that he relates to. And one of those concepts that the Greeks had, which we've lost, is this thing called the thymotic urge, thumos. And this is the desire for recognition, the desire for glory. We in our society focus a lot on the desire for money, but the Greeks believed that what we really want is to be recognized, for people to know who we are and to admire us. And the Greeks emphasized that this is why we fight, this is why we sacrifice for a cause. And in reading about Greek history, Harold, my character, relates to something larger than himself, something deep in his own nature. And she really leads him on a tour of how to learn, how to study things, how to absorb facts, but not only that, but how to tap into his unconscious, how unconsciously, when we absorb facts, we're playing with ideas, we're trying to make connections. And she leads him on this multi-stage process, which is like a conversation between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, and which is what education is. It's not just downloading information into a blank slate. It's playing with our connections, playing with connections to really force them to reach some conclusions and to build things.
What plays into where we land politically?
Well, that is mostly cultural. A lot of it is determined by where we live. If you grow up in Wyoming, you're likely to be Republican, and grow up in Berkeley, California, you're likely to be Democrat. Mm-hmm. But the decision to become a member of one party or another, you know, in my world, we have a theory that we have at least a rationalization that people look at the opposing, say, healthcare plans or tax plans, and they vote for the party they think has the best plans. I've never actually met a person who made their political decisions that way. I think the evidence shows pretty clearly we pick the party that seems to be filled with people more or less like ourselves. And so it's social identity. And that's not stupid. We want our political leaders to react as we would react. But the interesting thing is the social identity comes first, and then our philosophy comes later. So if you look at people, as various political scientists have done, they become Republicans, and then they develop a free market philosophy. They become Democrats, and then they develop more of an egalitarian political philosophy. So the social identification comes first. The ideology comes second.
That's really interesting because there's a lot of research coming out that I'm sure you're aware of now that says that Americans' religious preferences are influenced in very much the same way.
Right, and that's what religion is. It's in many ways, at least the denomination we have to be a member of, it's a form of community, and we want to be around people who, you know, we fit in with. And faith in God is one thing, but the faith in the decision to be a member of one church or another is sort of a different process. I remember I was covering the presidential election, I think two election cycles ago, and almost every candidate in the Democratic primary field had switched denominations at some point in their lives. I think Wesley Clark, who was running, had switched from Catholic to Episcopalian. I think Howard Dean had switched from one Protestant denomination to another because he didn't like one church's stand on a bike path running through his town. And so we have a tendency to switch denominations very quickly in the United States, and we do that in search of community.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is David Brooks. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Let's go on the line now to Dirk in Dallas. Hello, Dirk.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. The first thing I wanted to say was that to Mr. Brooks is thank you for writing the book. I've been really enjoying what I've read about it so far, and it's quite heartening. I'm hoping that it will influence some communication across political lines. It's something I'm going to bring into a learning group of organizational development professionals that I'm part of. And the question I had particularly had to do with, in terms of reason and emotion, Stephen Colbert has this, he does it with tongue-in-cheek, but this idea of truthiness, where we decide things, and he says, you know, never mind the facts, I feel it in my gut. Is that something that you consider really active, and how does it show up in politics?
I actually did the Colbert Report 2 weeks ago, and he said, I really like your book because it means I don't have to think about anything. And I said to him, well, you're confusing emotion with horniness. They're not the same thing. And he's sort of wrong about that. I mean, it is true that very often our intuitions are smart, but they're not reliable all the time. And so one of the traits that the scientists talk about is called metacognition, which is the ability to look inside your own biases, be aware of where you're smart and where you're not smart. So, for example, we all have a tendency to be overconfident. 96% of college professors in America believe they have above-average teaching skills. Time magazine asked Americans, are you in the top 1% of Americans? And 19% of Americans think they're in the top 1%. And so if you're aware that you're biased in the direction of overconfidence, then you have to build modesty bootstraps for yourself. Warren Buffett and others are famous for doing this, for saying, I'm probably not as smart as I think I am, so how am I going to compensate for that? And then the other thing to be pointed out is you just because you say something is emotional does not mean you have no control over it. You can have smart emotions or dumb emotions, supple emotions or crude emotions. And the way you build sophisticated, supple emotions is through art and literature and by moving along with other characters and then sort of expanding your repertoire of emotions and also by studying. By studying the facts of a field unconsciously, you will refine those facts and see the world in a different way. One experiment that did this, it gave people chess grandmasters and novices a 5-second look at a chessboard, and then asked them to describe the location of the pieces they had seen. And the chess grandmasters could describe where every piece on the board was, and the novices could only pick up about 4 or 5. And that's because grandmasters who've played chess a lot see, essentially, they see paragraphs. They see formations of chess pieces, whereas the novices see the individual pieces. And experience helps you see the world in better and different ways. And so it is important to study and to learn facts and to rewire your intuitions that way. So it's not simply enough to sit back and say, hey, if it seems truthy to me, if it feels good, then I'll go with that. And that's sort of what Colbert's making fun of.
I want to go off on a quick little tangent there. I happened to catch that appearance. You can call it part of my research for this interview with you. Is it frustrating when you've got a point to make and Colbert maybe has a different agenda in mind? He's trying to have his show out there and he wants to let you get a little out there. But is it frustrating or do you sort of go on knowing, well, the title will be mentioned, I've got this nationwide audience and I'll not worry about how much I get in?
Yeah, you don't worry about that. It's like for me I've been on Colbert three times, and the first time it was phenomenally hard because you don't know who you're talking to. Is it a human being or is it a character?
Uh-huh.
And then you realize it's just a character. Don't try to think about the human being. Just think about the character that's in front of you. And so once you assume it's like that, it's just like being in a tugboat in a gale or a rowboat. You're just there. He's going to come at you in a million different ways. Just go with the flow and ride along and see where he goes.
And do they tell you ahead of time, just play it straight no matter what he's doing and pretend that this is a real guy?
They more or less do that. I try to be aggressive. I try to attack him. And so that gives him something to play off. So each time I've gone, I've tried to insult him as often as possible.
Seems to be working for you. David Brooks is my guest. He's a columnist for The New York Times and commentator for PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David Brooks will be in town on Wednesday, March 30th to address the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live Series in partnership with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information about that appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to jump on the line to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Brooks. He is a columnist for The New York Times and commentator for PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. I really like where you describe two characters falling in love, and it's as much like a job interview as anything else, as people sort of sit down and have those first intensive conversations that people tend to have when they are falling in love. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. The act of falling in love is like the act of deciding anything else. It's not a separate weird decision-making process. It's the same, and a lot of it is unconscious. And so we tend to marry people with similar nose widths, similar eye widths apart. We tend to marry people with as much status as we can get. And unfortunately, women tend to prefer guys who are taller, since each inch of height correlates to about $6,000 in income in the contemporary United States. But I did see a good piece of research that's showing that an online dating site, a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers as a guy who's 6 foot, so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. So these are all things that are going through our minds, which are unconscious and emotional, but also quite rational, if you want to, at least in evolutionary terms. But the other thing that's going on as we talk is we're mimicking each other, and one of the decisions whether or not to fall in love depends on how well that mimicry happens. And some of it is conscious, and my characters in the book discover they have some of the same posters on their walls. They have the same attitudes towards the characters in The Breakfast Club. They saw some of the same rock bands on the same tours, and these things seem to blend together and gave their relationship a sense of destiny fulfilled. But some of the things we're not aware of. And so whether people have the same vocabulary levels, whether they roughly mesh, that matters quite a lot. Whether we smell alike, smell is tremendously powerful in whether we fall in love. One of the bits of research I saw, they decided to study which is more emotionally corrosive, losing your sense of sight or losing your sense of smell. And I think most of us think that losing sight would have a bigger impact on our life. But in fact, the people who lost a sense of smell suffered much greater emotional deterioration because so many of our relationships with other people are influenced by smell. And people who marry each other have tend to marry people with similar immune systems or with complementary immune systems. And we get that through tasting each other's saliva and through sense of smell. And so all these factors are going in to the decision of falling in love. And of course, it's not a conscious decision. The feeling of being in love sort of wells up inside one, and it sort of takes one over. And once it happens, it changes everything. We become much more active. We have this ferocious desire to be with the other person. The scientists who study this, the brains of people in love, say love looks very much like cocaine addiction or any other kind of addiction. It's an intense desire in certain areas of the brain, which to be with one another. And then it changes everything else. Stendhal had a great line, a great word called crystallization. He described a salt mine in Austria that the miners would throw branches into the mine, and then they'd collect them a few weeks later, and the branches would be covered with these shimmering crystals, which would make the branches so much more beautiful. And he said, when we're in love with someone, we crystallize them. We imagine they possess beautiful qualities that maybe they don't or maybe we didn't see before. But the act of being in love changes our perception of that person.
And then we get married and move in together, and so some of those crystals fall off, and we better hope we chose wisely.
Yeah, and there's a great bit of research showing there are really two different forms of love. The first burst of love, which is romantic and very tempestuous, but then the later, more steady love, which is harder but calmer. And the second love, companionship love, has been very rarely written about by writers and novelists. But the one story I've seen that really describes it was written by Tolstoy. It's called Family Happiness. And it's about moving from that first tempestuous love to the steadier and more longer-lasting companionship.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Tara in McKinney. Hi, Tara.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Great discussion today. My question was on that same topic about love and if there's been any research to indicate that there's a difference in the longevity of a relationship if it's based on that early romantic love or if the relationship had some time to settle into that more rational, you know, comfortable companionship, and if the power of that initial falling in love can carry a relationship through the course of a lifetime or if it's that more rational love that that tends to last longer.
Yeah, that's a good question. There has been a fair bit of research, and one thing I just came across recently was, and this is sort of reconfirming traditional values, is that couples who delayed their first sexual activity had longer relationships than those that don't. Now, I don't know if that's because they delayed because they wanted to restrain themselves or because they were simply less impulsive people across a range of spheres. Hmm. But it is true that the more you wait, the longer the relationship tends to be. The second thing, and there's a researcher named John Gottman who looks at couples very early in their relationship, and he can predict with great accuracy how long the marriage is going to last and which couple is in danger of divorce by how they listen to each other. And if he sees in even a 15 or 20-minute conversation a sign that one partner has contempt for another, even a little glimpse, then he says that's a big warning sign.
So like eye rolling and stuff like that. Is that
right? Things like that. Or one partner is not listening or just not taking turns. And it's really the quality of the conversation between the two that he uses to make these predictions. And he, because he's been doing this all his life, is phenomenally good at making these kinds of predictions.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. Let's try Gary in Dallas. Hi, Gary.
Hi. You mentioned Antonio Damasio's books. I was wondering what you thought of his take on Spinoza's underrated philosophy and also you mentioned the emotional underlying roots of reason. I was wondering if you thought music should be more emphasized in education.
Yeah, those are good questions. Yeah, one of the things that this research does, it doesn't give us new views of human nature. Smart people have been looking at human beings for a long time, and they've observed a lot. And so people like philosophers like Spinoza or David Hume, people who lived hundreds of years ago, or Aristotle, who lived thousands of years ago, simply by sheer observation, they were able to arrive at the same things that we now can arrive at through brain research. And so what the science does is it reminds us which view of human nature is right and which view is not right. And so it really confirms the wisdom of people like Spinoza, the people who put great emphasis on the wisdom of our emotions, our sentiments, the people who said that our body is not separate from our brain, but our body and brain are in constant communication. The physical things are very important to how we think. And then the point about music is an excellent point, too. Just because we have emotions doesn't mean we can't educate them. And the way we educate our emotions is through art and music and literature. And one of the things that concerns me now in this era of budget cutting, and I'm for budget cutting, we do have to get our budgets under control or reduce our debt. But a lot of the things that we're cutting are things people think are peripheral, say, to education, like music and art. But I think a lot of the research shows that these things are actually much more central than we think because they do educate the emotions.
Another thing you write about is the fact that a social connection, like a club that people go to once a month and meet with people they really care about, is more important to happiness than a big bump in salary.
Yeah, there's been a great body of research on what leads to happiness. And the simple summary is that up until a certain point, money sort of helps. If you're poor, it helps to become middle class.
Sure.
But once you achieve middle class, it doesn't help that much. It helps a little, but not that much. But the relationship between having friends and partners and happiness, that is a very strong relationship. So joining a club that meets once a month produces the same happiness gain as doubling your income. Getting married produces the same happiness gain as increasing your income by $100,000 a year. And basically, it's a very simple formula. The more people you're around regularly, the happier you're likely to be. And I should say that just because I'm emphasizing the sociability doesn't mean we all have to be party animals. We don't have to all be gregarious, wild and crazy guys or gals. You can commune very intensely with a writer, someone who's long dead, who you feel connected to, or a musician, or anything else. You don't have to be completely, dancing till 2 a.m. But it helps to be around other people. The daily activity, according to research by a guy named Daniel Kahneman, which contributes most to happiness, is eating out with friends. The daily activity that detracts from happiness most is commuting, because you're often alone there in the car.
Is there much research yet, David, on the value of digital communication with another human being as compared with that takes place face-to-face?
Yes, and the evidence is that it's better to be face-to-face. So at the University of Michigan, they did research. They gave one set of groups math problems, and they had them meet for 10 minutes face-to-face, and these groups could solve the problems pretty easily. Other groups, they gave them 30 minutes to solve the problems, but they communicated by email, and these groups could not solve the problems. They broke up. And that's part of a whole group of research that tells people in business to be wary of, say, teleconferences, and that face-to-face communication really is a lot better because so much of our communication is through gesture and through smell and through other subtle things. So it's really important to meet face-to-face. And it's made me wonder about teenagers who spend so much time texting and on Facebook. And here I would say the research is inconclusive, whether Facebook supplements normal social activity or tries to replace it. And I guess my sense, and it's just a guess right now, is that it supplements activity, that kids are on Facebook, but they're also meeting face-to-face. But if you see a teenager, spending 30 hours a weekend just on Facebook, that's not a replacement for real friendship.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the reality that these days they need an extra, 5 or 7 years of adolescence before we sort of consider them full-fledged adults.
That's interesting. I hadn't made that connection, but that could be. And the world is more complicated. And one of the things that happens, and this sort of would support your theory, is that the social structure of people in their 20s is different than before and after. They're what they call urban tribes. There are gangs of people in their 20s, sort of loose, informal gangs of 20 or 30 people who meet, who support each other, who pick each other up for the airport, help each other move, meet for coffee, whatever. And these are sort of tribes of people in their 20s really forming these new sorts of social relationships, which are after the family they were raised in, but before the family they're going to form as parents.
You mentioned, David, that people have been thinking about this kind of understanding of human nature and of wisdom for thousands of years. Why do you think in the modern age it is still so hard for us to trust our unconscious selves?
Well, we do have this voice in our head that's telling us what it's doing, and sometimes it's lying to us. It gives itself credit for all sorts of things it thinks it controls. And then I think we've also become smitten with tools that we've developed to understand society, whether it's economic models or computer models or political science models. And the models seem to have great power. In the 19th century, Marx had a model that you could explain human behavior by material incentives, your relationships to the means of production. And these models seem to explain everything, and they tend to emphasize material things that we can count and measure. And so we get seduced into thinking, we've got a system for explaining everything. And that's a very seductive thing. But the fact is we're more complicated than that, and those systems generally break apart.
What did you learn in all this research that might help us get along better and empathize better with people whose views seem radically different from our own?
Well, the phrase that I put in the book is the phrase epistemological modesty. There's so much going on down there that we should be very modest about what we can know about ourselves, what we can know about the world. And if you go into life with a sense of modesty that the world is more complicated than you can know, then you become aware that you need others, you need people who disagree with you to counterbalance your own failures and your own weaknesses. And if you don't go in with a sense of modesty, then you think people who disagree with you are just in the way. But if there's one thing this research shows is that we are way more complex than we even appear. And we should be very cautious about thinking we know ourselves or know, let alone know other people.
The last thing I want to ask you, and we just have about 30 seconds left. Do we need to be careful that our unconscious occasionally embraces things that make the wrong choices, things like racism and xenophobia?
Yes, it's very strong in dividing between in-group and out-group. That's a tremendously powerful thing. We have an impulse to want to dominate others, to exercise power over others. So I've been emphasizing the strengths of the unconscious mind, but it comes with its own weaknesses that cause a lot of misery through life. And you got to be aware of that and try to build safeguards against those things.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times, commentator for PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
You can see David Brooks at the Dallas Museum of Arts Arts and Letters Live event March 30th at 7:30. Find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.